The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2, Section 2, Continued.
Cassette 1, Side 2.
In 1947, at Revuchi, the penalty camp for the Krasnoyarsk camps, they brought in about 40 Japanese officers, so-called war criminals, though one could not even imagine what they were guilty of in relation to us. It was bitterly cold. There was logging, unbearable even for Russians. The Otrytsalovka, the band of rejectors, swiftly stole the clothes from some of them and swiped the whole tray with their bread several times. The members of the Otrytsalovka took the position, "I reject everything the chiefs demand of me, both the regimen and the work." Customarily, this was a powerful nucleus of thieves. The Japanese, in dismay, waited for the chiefs to intervene, but the chiefs, of course, paid no attention. Then their brigadier, Colonel Kondo, accompanied by two senior officers, went one evening to the office of the camp chief and warned him, they knew Russian very well, that if the violence against them did not stop, two officers who had announced their desire to do so would commit harakiri at dawn the next morning, and this would be only the beginning. The chief of the camp, the blockhead Yegorov, former political commissar of a regiment, immediately sensed that he could very easily come to a bad end because of this. For 2 days, the Japanese brigade was not taken out to work, was fed normally, and then taken off the penalty regimen. How little was required for struggle and victory, merely not to cling to life. A life that was, in any case, already lost. But our 58s were kept constantly mixed with the thieves and the non-political offenders, and were never allowed to be alone together, so they wouldn't look into one another's eyes and realize who we are. And those bright heads, hot tongues, and firm hearts, who might have become prison and camp leaders, had all, on the basis of special notations in their files, been culled out, gagged, and hidden away in special isolators, and shot in cellars. However, in accordance with that important phenomenon of life noted already in the teachings of Taoism, we were bound to expect that the moment the political ceased to exist was also the very moment when they appeared. I will risk declaring that in the Soviet period not only were there genuine politicals, but also that, one, there were more of them than in Tsarist times, and, two, they manifested more steadfastness and courage than did the earlier revolutionaries. This seems to contradict the preceding, but it does not. The politicals in Tsarist Russia were in a very favorable situation, very much in the public eye, producing immediate repercussions in society and the press. And we have already seen, in Part 1, Chapter 12, that in Soviet Russia the socialists had things incomparably more difficult. And not only socialists were now politicals, the politicals were splashed in tubfuls into the 15 million criminal ocean, and they were invisible and inaudible to us. They were mute, they were muter than all the rest. Their image was the fish. The fish, symbol of the early Christians, and the Christians were their principal contingent. Clumsy, semi-literate, unable to deliver speeches from the rostrum or compose an underground proclamation, which their faith made unnecessary anyway, they went off to camp to face tortures and death, only so as not to renounce their faith. They knew very well for what they were serving time, and they were unwavering in their convictions. They were the only ones, perhaps, to whom the camp philosophy and even the camp language did not stick. And were these not politicals? Well, you'd certainly not call them riffraff. And women among them were particularly numerous. The Tao says, "When faith collapses, that is when the true believers appear." Because of our enlightened scoffing at Orthodox priests, the squalling of the Komsomol members on Easter night, and the whistles of the thieves at the transit prisons, we overlook the fact that the sinful Orthodox Church had nonetheless nurtured daughters worthy of the first centuries of Christianity, sisters of those thrown to the lions and the arenas. There was a multitude of Christians, prisoner transports and graveyards, prisoner transports and graveyards. Who will count those millions? They died unknown, casting only in their immediate vicinity a light like a candle. They were the best of Russia's Christians. The worst had all trembled, recanted, and gone into hiding. Is this not more? Was there ever a time when Tsarist Russia had known that many politicals? Tsarist Russia could not even count them in tens of thousands. But so cleanly, so unwitnessed, was the strangling of our politicals that it is only rarely that the story of one or another surfaces for us. Archpriest Preobrazhensky, the face of a Tolstoy, a grey beard. Prison, exile, camp, prison, exile, camp. The big solitaire. After being worn down in this way for many, many years, in 1943 he was summoned to the Lubyanka, and on the way there the thieves stole his tall cylindrical priest's hat. It was proposed to him that he become a member of the Synod. It would seem that after so many years he might have allowed himself some respite from prison. But no, he refused. It was not a pure Synod, not a pure church. And back to camp. And what about Valentin Feliksovich Voino-Yasinetsky, 1877-1961, Archbishop Luke and author of the famous work Purulent Surgery? His biography will, of course, be compiled, and it is not for us to write about him here. This man abounded in talent. Before the revolution, he had already successfully competed for entry into the Academy of Arts, but had left it in order to serve humanity better as a physician. In the hospitals of World War I, he emerged as an expert eye surgeon. And after the revolution, he headed a Tashkent clinic, extremely popular in all Central Asia. A smooth and untroubled career was spread out before him, like the paths trod by our highly successful contemporaries. But Voino-Yasinetsky sensed that his service was insufficient, and he put on the robes of a priest. He hung an icon in his operating room, and delivered his lectures to his students wearing clerical robes and with a cross around his neck, 1921. Patriarch Tikhon managed to appoint him Bishop of Tashkent. In the 20s, Voino-Yasinetsky was exiled to the Turukhansky region, but was then brought back, thanks to the exertions of many, but his chair and his diocese had already been taken. He had a private practice, the sign on his door reading Bishop Luke, and masses of the sick poured in to see him. The leather coats, too, in secret. And he gave what he did not need of his money to the poor. It is worth noting how they got rid of him. He had been sent to his second exile in Archangel in 1930, not as a 58, but for inciting to murder. This was a nonsensical story, according to which he had brought influence to bear on the wife and mother-in-law of the physiologist Mikhailovsky, who committed suicide, and who, when already insane, had been engaged in injecting into corpses solutions which had allegedly stopped the disintegration of tissue, about which the newspapers made a big to-do as a triumph of Soviet science and artificial resurrection. This administrative method compels us to take an even more informal approach to the question of who the real politicals were. If not struggle with the regime, then moral or energetic resistance to it. That is the chief criterion. And the matter of which article was pasted on didn't mean a thing. Many sons of the liquidated kulaks were given thieves' articles, but in camp showed themselves to be genuine politicals. In exile in Archangel, Voino-Yasinetsky worked out a new method of healing purulent wounds. He was summoned to Leningrad, and Kirov himself tried to persuade him to lay aside his priest's robes and immediately offered him his own institute. But the stubborn bishop would not even consent to have his book published without an indication, in parentheses, of his clerical rank. And thus it was that without an institute and without his book, he completed his exile in 1933, returned to Tashkent, and there was sentenced to a third term of exile in the Krasnoyarsk region. From the beginning of the war, he worked in Siberian hospitals, where he applied his technique of healing purulent wounds, and this led him to a Stalin Prize, and he only agreed to accept it dressed in his full bishop's regalia. When medical students today ask about his biography, they receive the reply, "There is no literature on him." And the engineers, how many of them refused to sign stupid, disgusting confessions of wrecking, and was scattered to the four winds and shot. And how Pyotr Akimovich, Joachimovich Palchinsky, 1875 to 1929, gleams like a bright star among them. He was an engineer and scholar with an astonishing breadth of interests, a graduate, in 1900, of the Mining Institute, an outstanding authority on mining. He studied and, as can be seen from the list of his books, left behind him works on general questions of economic development, on the fluctuations of industrial prices, on the export of coal, on the equipment and operation of Europe's trading ports, on the economic problems of port management, on industrial safety techniques in Germany, on concentration in the German and English mining industries, on the economics of mining, on the reconstruction and development of the building materials industry in the USSR, on the general training of engineers in higher education, and, in addition, works on purely mining subjects, such as descriptions of individual areas and individual ore deposits, and not all his works are yet known to us today. Like Voino Jasenetsky in medicine, Palchinsky would never have come to grief in his own engineering work, but just as the former could not stop propagating the faith, so he could not stop meddling in politics. Even as a student in the Mining Institute, Palchinsky had been listed by the Tsarist gendarmes as a leader of the movement. In 1900, he had been the chairman of a students' assembly. As an engineer in 1905 in Irkutsk, he had already been prominently involved in the revolutionary uprisings, and in the case of the Irkutsk Republic, he was sentenced to hard labor. He escaped and went off to Europe. Having already before this been in sympathy with the anarchists, he became friendly with Kropotkin. He used his emigre years to perfect his knowledge in several engineering areas and studied European technology and economics. But at the same time, he never lost sight of the program of popular publications for disseminating anarchist ideas among the masses. In 1913, amnestied, he returned to Russia and wrote to Kropotkin, "In view of the program of my own activities in Russia, I aim to take part, wherever I am able, in the general development of the productive forces of the country, and in the development of spontaneous social and public activity in the broadest sense of this word." During his first trip through the main Russian centers, he was snowed under with suggestions to stand for such positions as business manager of the Council of the Congress of the Mining Industry, offered brilliant positions in directorships in the Donbass, consultancies to banks, lecturer in the Mining Institute, the post of director of the Department of Mines. There were few men in Russia with such energy and such broad knowledge. And what was his further fate? We have already reported above, Part 1, Chapter 10, how in World War I he became a deputy chairman of the War Industry Committee, and after the February Revolution, deputy minister of Trade and Industry. As evidently the most energetic of the members of the weak-willed provisional government, Palchinsky was successively Governor-General of Petrograd during the Kornilov days and Chief of Defense of the Winter Palace during the October Revolution. Immediately afterward, he was imprisoned in the Peter and Paul Fortress and served 4 months there. Then, it's true, he was released. In June 1918, he was arrested without any charges being made against him. On September the 6th, 1918, he was included in a list of 122 prominent hostages. "If even one Soviet official is killed, the hostages listed below will be shot," signed Petrograd Cheka, G. Boki, chairman, A. Yoselevich, secretary. However, he was not shot, and at the end of 1918 he was even released because of the inappropriate intervention of the German social democrat Karl Moor, who was astounded at the kind of people we were leaving to rot in prison. From 1920 on, he was a professor at the Mining Institute, visited Kropotkin in Dmitrov, and after Kropotkin's death, not long afterward, created a committee for the unsuccessful perpetuation of Kropotkin's memory, and soon, either because of or notwithstanding this, was again arrested. A curious document on the release of Palchinsky from this third Soviet imprisonment has been preserved in the archives, a letter to the Moscow Rev Tribunal dated January the 16th, 1922. Considering that the permanent consultant of the State Planning Commission, engineer P.A. Palchinski, is to deliver a report in the Southern Bureau on January the 18th of this year at 3 p.m. on the question of restoring southern metallurgy, which is of particularly important significance at the present moment, the Presidium of the State Planning Commission requests the Rev Tribunal to release Comrade Palchinski by the above-named hour in order that he may carry out the assignment given him. Chairman of the State Planning Commission, Krzyżanowski. Krzyżanowski asked, and without much authority either, and only because southern metallurgy was of particularly important significance at the present moment, and only in order that Palchinski may carry out the assignment given him. Otherwise, you can do whatever you want with him, or put him back in his cell, if you please. No, Palchinski was permitted to go on working for a while, reconstructing the mining industry of the USSR. After showing heroic steadfastness in prison, he was shot without trial in 1929. You would have to have no love whatever for your country. You would have to be hostile to it, to shoot the pride of the nation, its concentrated knowledge, energy, and talent. And wasn't it exactly the same 12 years later in the case of Nikolai Ivanovich Vavilov? Was not Vavilov a genuine political, out of bitter necessity? In the course of 11 months of interrogation, he endured 400 interrogation sessions. And at his trial, July the 9th, 1941, he refused to confess to the charges against him. And without any world fame whatever, the hydraulic engineer Professor Rodionov, Vitkovsky has told us about him, refused to work at his profession when he was imprisoned, though that would have been the easy path for him. He cobbled boots. Was he not a genuine political? He was a peaceful hydraulic engineer. He had never prepared for struggle. But if, despite his prison keepers, he held fast to his convictions, was he not a genuine political? What need had he for some party membership card for that? Just as a star suddenly flares to 100 times its previous brightness and then fades away, so too a human being not disposed to be a political may nonetheless flare up briefly and intensely in prison and perish as a result. Ordinarily, we do not learn about these cases. Sometimes there is a witness to tell about them. Sometimes there is merely a faded piece of paper in front of us on which we can only build hypotheses. Yakov Yefimovich Pochta, 1887, non-party, physician. From the beginning of the war, he was at the 45th Air Force Base of the Black Sea Fleet. His first sentence from a court-martial at the Sevastopol base, November the 17th, 1941, was 5 years of corrective labor camp. This would seem to be not too bad, but what's this? There was a second sentence on November the 22nd, to be shot. And on November the 27th, he was shot. What happened in those fateful 5 days between the 17th and the 22nd? Did he explode like a star? Or was it merely that the judges suddenly realized they had given him too little? He has now been rehabilitated on the initial charges, and that means that if it had not been for the second case against him... What about the Trotskyites? They were pure-blooded politicals. That's something you cannot deny them. Someone is shouting at me. A little bell is being jingled at me. Stop right there. Speak about the one and only politicals, about the uncrushable communists who even in the camps continue to keep the sacred faith. All right, we will set aside the next chapter separately for them. Someday historians will study the question, at what moment did a trickle of political young people begin to flow in our country? It seems to me that it began in 1943 and 1944. I'm not referring here to the socialist and Trotskyite young people. While still practically schoolboys, they suddenly began to seek out their own platform. Remember the Democratic Party of 1944? Different from the one that was being intensely urged on them and shoved under their feet. Well, what else can we call them? Only that we know nothing of them and never will. But if 22-year-old Arkady Belinkov was imprisoned for his first novel, A Rough Draft of Feelings, 1943, never published, of course, and continued to write in camp, but at death's door trusted the stool pigeon Kermayer and was handed another sentence. Can we really deny him the title of political? In 1950, the students of the Leningrad School of Mechanics created their own party with a program and statutes. Many were shot. Aaron Levin, who got 25 years for it, told us. And that is all, a roadside marker. And it goes without saying that our contemporary politicals need incomparably greater steadfastness and heroism than the earlier revolutionaries. In those days, the punishments given for far more serious actions were quite light, and revolutionaries didn't have to be so very bold. In case of failure, they risked only themselves, not their families, and not even their heads, but a short term only. What did posting leaflets amount to before the revolution? It was an amusement, like scaring pigeons, and you wouldn't even get 3 months for it. But five boys in Vladimir Gershuny's group prepared leaflets declaring that our government has compromised itself. This required approximately the same determination as the five boys in Alexander Ulyanov's group needed in their attempt to assassinate the Tsar. And how the following story blazes up through spontaneous combustion, how it comes awake on its own somewhere inside. In the city of Leninsk-Kuznetsky was one boys' school. Starting in the ninth grade, five boys, Misha Bakst, their Komsomol organizer, Tolya Tarantin, also a Komsomol activist, Velvel Reichtman, Nikolai Konev, and Yuri Anikonov, lost their peace of mind. Not over the girls, nor over the latest dances. They looked around them at the savagery and drunkenness in their own city and pored over their history textbooks, trying to make connections and compare. As they entered the 10th grade in 1950, just before the elections to the local Soviets, they produced their first and last naive leaflet in printed characters. Listen, worker. Are we really living the kind of life for which our grandfathers, fathers, and brothers fought? We work and get only a pitiful pittance in return, and they even cut down on that too. Read this and think about your life. They themselves were only thinking, and therefore they did not summon to any particular action. Their plan was to issue a series of such leaflets and to make their own hectograph. Here is how they posted the leaflets. They went around together at night. One of them would plaster four pieces of wet bread on the wall, and another would paste a leaflet on them. In early spring, some new pedagogue came to them in class and asked them to fill out a questionnaire, printing the letters. The boys were sold down the river by Fyodor Polnonyanshikov, later party organizer at the Polisayev mine. The country must know its stool pigeons. The principal pleaded that they not be arrested before the end of the school year. Imprisoned and under interrogation, the boys regretted most of all not being at their own graduation party. Who is directing you? Confess. The Gaivisti simply couldn't believe that the boys had been guided simply by their own consciences. After all, it was an extraordinary occurrence. After all, you only live once. Why think about things? Punishment blocks, night interrogations, long hours of standing. A session of the provincial court closed to the public, of course. The judge's name was Pushkin. He was soon afterward convicted of accepting bribes. Pitiable defense lawyers, confused judicial assessors, a threatening prosecutor named Trutnev. And all of them given 8- and 10-year sentences, and all of them 17-year-olds sent to special camps. No, the old proverb does not lie. Look for the brave in prison and the stupid among the political leaders. I am writing for Mute Russia, and therefore I have but little to say about the Trotskyites. They are all people who write, and any who have succeeded in surviving, have in all probability prepared detailed memoirs and will write their dramatic epics more completely and more accurately than I could. But here are a few words for the sake of the overall picture. They conducted a regular underground struggle in the late 20s, deploying all their experience as former revolutionaries, except that the GPU arrayed against them was not as stupid as the Tsarist Okhrana. I do not know whether they were prepared for that total annihilation which Stalin had allotted them, or whether they still thought that it would all end with jokes and reconciliation. In any case, they were heroic people. I fear, however, that if they had come to power, they would have brought us a madness no better than Stalin's. Let us note that even in the 30s, when their end was near, they still considered any kind of contact with the socialists to be a betrayal and a disgrace, and therefore kept to themselves in the isolators and would not even pass on the prison mail of the socialists. You see, they considered themselves Leninists. The wife of Ion Smirnov, even after his execution, avoided contact with the socialists so that the jailers would not see it, that is, so to say, the eyes of the Communist Party. One gets the impression, though I will not insist on it, that there was too much vanity in their political struggle in camp conditions, which gave it a touch of tragicomedy. In the cattle trains from Moscow to the Kolyma, they used to agree on underground contacts, passwords, and they were scattered among various camps and various brigades. For instance, a brigade of prisoners sent up for counter-revolutionary Trotskyite activity, which had honestly earned its work ration, was suddenly put on penalty rations. What was to be done? The well-hidden underground Communist Party cell discussed the question, should they strike? But this would have meant to nibble the bait of the provocation. They want us to fall for their provocation, but we will go proudly to work even without our ration. We will go to work, but we will work on a penalty norm basis. This was 1937, and the brigade included not only pure Trotskyites, but also pure Orthodox Stalinists, sentenced as Trotskyites. They had sent petitions to the Central Committee addressed to Comrade Stalin, to the NKVD addressed to Comrade Yezhov, to the Central Executive Committee addressed to Comrade Kalinin, and to the Prosecutor General also. And at the time they were anxious to avoid a falling out with the camp chiefs, on whom would depend the accompanying recommendations. At Utini Goldfield, they were making preparations for the 20th anniversary of the October Revolution. They collected black rags, and they blackened white ones with charcoal. On the morning of November the 7th, they intended to hang black mourning flags on all the tents, and to sing the Internationale at line-up, locking arms firmly so as not to allow the jailers or the convoy guards into their ranks. They were determined to sing it through, no matter what. And then, not under any circumstances, to leave the camp compound to work, and to shout slogans, "Down with fascism! Hail Leninism! Hail the great October Socialist Revolution!" In this plan, we find a sort of hysterical enthusiasm mixed with futility, bordering on the ridiculous. However, someone, or one of themselves, turned them in ahead of time, and on November the 6th they were taken to Yubilyny Goldfield, and locked in for the holidays. In closed tents, which they were forbidden to leave, they sang the Internationale, just as the Jubilani sloggers were going out to work. But even among those singing there was a division. Present were unjustly imprisoned communists who stood aside, who did not sing the Internationale, but showed their orthodoxy by their silence. "If we are being kept behind bars, that means we are still worth something," Alexander Boyarchikov consoled himself. A false consolation. Who didn't they keep there? The greatest achievement of the Trotskyites in the camp struggle was their hunger strike and work stoppage throughout the entire Vorkuta system of camps. Before that also, there had been a 100-day strike somewhere in the Kolyma, it seems. They demanded a free settlement instead of camps, and they won. They were promised satisfaction, and the hunger strike was lifted. They were scattered among various camps, where they were gradually annihilated. The information I have on the Vorkuta hunger strike is contradictory. Here is approximately how it went. It began on October the 27th, 1936, and continued for 132 days. They were fed artificially, but did not lift the hunger strike. Several died of starvation. Their demands were separation of the politicals from the criminals. Did they include among those politicals the 58s other than themselves? Probably not. If they had rejected even the socialists, they were unable to recognize the KRs as their brothers. An 8-hour work day. the restoration of the special ration for politicals, and the issuing of rations independently of work performance. This, of course, was solely for themselves. Destruction of the OSO, the special board, and annulment of its verdicts. They were fed through a tube, and thereupon a rumour spread through the camps that there was a shortage of sugar and butter because it had all been fed to the Trotskyites, a trick worthy of the Blue Caps. In March 1937, a telegram came from Moscow. The demands of the hunger strikers are to be accepted in toto. The hunger strike was lifted. Helpless prisoners, how could they enforce the fulfillment of those promises? They were just lied to. Not one of their demands was met. No Westerner will ever believe or comprehend that it was possible to act like this, but that's the whole story of our country. On the contrary, all the hunger strikers were processed through the security chief's office and charged with continuing their counter-revolutionary activity. The great hoot owl in the Kremlin had already thought up his short shrift for them. A bit later, at Vorkuta Mine No. 8, there was one more big hunger strike, which may have been part of the preceding one. 170 persons participated in it, certain of them known by name. The strikers' spokesman was Mikhail Shapiro, a former worker of the Kharkov VEF. Dmitry Kurinevsky from the Kiev Province Komsomol Committee. Ivanov, former commander of a squadron of patrol boats in the Baltic Fleet. Orlov Kamenetsky. Mikhail Andreevich. Polovoy Genkin. V.V. Verat, the editor of the Tbilisi newspaper, Zarya Vostoka, Dawn of the East. Sokrat Gorvorkian, secretary of the Central Committee of the Party in Armenia. Grigory Zolotnikov, a history professor, and his wife. The nucleus of the hunger strike consisted of 60 persons imprisoned together in 1927 and 1928 in the Verkhno-Uralsk isolator. It was a big surprise, gratifying to the strikers and unpleasant for the chiefs, that 20 thieves also joined in the strike, headed by their ringleader, who was known by the nickname of Moscow. In that camp he was famous for one night-time escapade. He had made his way to the camp chief's office and there relieved himself on the desk. Any of our politicals would have been shot for that, but all he got was a reprimand. It must have been the class enemy who taught you that. These 20 thieves truly irritated the chiefs, whereas the security officer of Vorkutlag, Uchkov, taunted the hunger strike leadership of hostile prisoners by saying, "Do you think that Europe knows about your strike? We don't give a damn about Europe." And he was right. But the socially friendly bandits could be neither beaten up nor allowed to die. However, halfway through the strike, things got through to their lumpen proletariat consciousness, and the thieves broke off, and their ringleader Moscow explained on the camp radio that the Trotskyites had deceived him. After this, the fate of the rest was to be shot. Their hunger strike had provided both their applications and the list of those executed. No, there were genuine politicals. There were many of them, and they sacrificed themselves. But why were the results of their opposition so insignificant? Why did they not leave even the scantiest bubbles on the surface? We will analyze this, too, later on. Chapter 11. The Loyalists. But I hear an angry roar of voices. The comrades' patience has run out. They will slam my book shut, toss it away, and spit on it. In the last analysis, this is brazen impudence. It's slander. Where is he looking for genuine politicals? Whom is he writing about? About some priests, technocrats, snivelling schoolboys? The real politicals are us. Us, the unshakable. Us, the orthodox, crystal-clear people. And Orwell called them good thinkers. Us, who even in the camp stayed faithful to the very end, to the one and only true... Yes, judging by our press and publishers, you were the only ones imprisoned by and large. Only you suffered. You are the only ones we are allowed to write about. All right, let's do it. Will the reader agree with this criterion, that political prisoners are those who know what they are serving time for, and are firm in their convictions? If you agree, then here is the answer. Our unshakable communists, who despite their personal arrest remained devoted to the one and only true, etc., were firm in their convictions, but did not know what they were serving time for, and therefore they cannot be considered political prisoners. If my criterion is no good, then let us take the criterion of Anna Skripnikova, who in the course of her 5 terms had time enough to think the matter over. Here it is. A political prisoner is one with beliefs whose renunciation could secure his release. People without such beliefs are political riffraff. In my opinion, this is not a bad criterion. All those who at any time have been persecuted for ideology fit into it. All revolutionaries fit into it. All the so-called nuns and the archpriest Preobrazhensky fit into it, and engineer Palchinsky. But the orthodox communists do not. Which beliefs are they being required to renounce? None. And that means that the orthodox communists, even though it is insulting to put it this way, are like that tailor and the deaf and dumb man and the club watchman who fitted into the category of helpless, uncomprehending victims, but with arrogance. Let us be precise and define our subject. Who are we going to be dealing with in this chapter? With all those who, despite their imprisonment, the mockery of an interrogation, their undeserved sentence, and the subsequent searing camp experiences, retained their communist convictions? No, not about all of them. Among them were people for whom this communist faith was an inner thing, sometimes the sole meaning of the lives remaining to them. But they did not let it lead them into taking a party attitude toward their imprisoned comrades, and in cell and barracks arguments they did not shout at others that these latter had been justly imprisoned, meaning that I was imprisoned unjustly. They did not rush to declare to the citizen camp chief and to the security chief, I am a communist, and did not use this formula to survive in camp. And now, when speaking of the past, they do not see the principal and only violence of the camps to have consisted in the fact that communists were imprisoned and spit on all the rest. In a word, they were those whose communist convictions were inward and not constantly on the tips of their tongues. It was as if this were an individualist trait, but in fact such individuals did not ordinarily hold big jobs in freedom, and in camp they worked as ordinary sloggers. Take, for example, Avenir Borisov, a village schoolteacher. Do you remember our youth? I myself was born in 1912, when our supreme happiness was the green Jungsturm uniform made out of homespun cloth, with a waist belt and a shoulder strap, when we despised money and everything private and personal, and were ready to march in any cause as soon as the summons came. I joined the Komsomol at the age of 13, and when I was all of 24 years old, the NKVD organs charged me with nearly every section in Article 58. We will see later how he conducted himself after his release. He is a decent person. Or Boris Mikhailovich Vinogradov, with whom I served time in prison. In his youth, he had been a locomotive engineer. Not just for 1 year, either, in the way that certain deputies were shepherds for a year. After the workers' school and an institute, he became a railway transport engineer, and was not put immediately on party work, as often happens, too. And he was a good engineer. In the Sharashka, he carried out complex calculations in gas dynamics for jet turbines. But by 1941, it's true, he had become the party organizer of the Moscow Institute for Railroad Engineering. In the bitter Moscow days of October the 16th and 17th, 1941, seeking instructions, he telephoned, but no one replied. He went to the district party committee, the city party committee, the provincial party committee, and found no one there. Everyone had scattered to the winds. Their chambers were empty. And it seems he didn't go any higher than that. He returned to his own people in the institute and declared, "Comrades, all the leaders have run away. But we are communists, we will join the defense." And they did just that. But for that remark of his, they have all run away. Those who had run away sent him, who had not run away, to prison for 8 years, for anti-Soviet propaganda. He was a quiet worker, a dedicated friend, and only in heart-to-heart conversation would he disclose that he believed, believes, and will go on believing. And he never wore it on his sleeve. Or take the geologist Nikolai Kalistratovich Govorko, who, when he was a Vorkuta last legger, composed his Ode to Stalin, which has been preserved. But he did not write it for publication, nor in order to receive privileges in return, but because it poured straight from his heart, and he hid that ode in the mine. Though what was there to hide? Sometimes such people kept their faith to the end. Sometimes, like Kovacs, a Hungarian from Philadelphia arrested in 1937, who belonged to one of the 39 families who'd come to found a commune near Kakhovka. They refused, after rehabilitation, to take back their party card. Certain others broke away even earlier, like another Hungarian named Szabo, who had been commander of a Siberian partisan detachment in the Civil War. Back in 1937, he had declared in prison, "If I were free right now, I'd collect my partisans together, raise Siberia, and march on Moscow and chase all those bastards out." So we are not going to deal in this chapter with communists of either the first or the second kind. And the Orthodox communists themselves have eliminated all those who broke with the party, like the two Hungarians. Nor will we be concerned with such anecdotal individuals as those who in prison only pretended to be Orthodox communists so that the cell stoolie would give the interrogator a good report. Like the young Podkvakov, who when free had pasted up leaflets, but in the Spassk camp used to argue loudly with all opponents of the regime, including his own father, counting on lightening his own fate by this means. Here we shall concern ourselves particularly with those Orthodox communists who made a display of their ideological orthodoxy, first to the interrogator, then in the prison cells, and then in camp to all and everyone, and now recall their camp past in this light. By a strange selective process, none of them will be sloggers. Such people ordinarily had held big jobs before their arrest and had had an enviable situation. And in camp they found it hardest of all to reconcile themselves to extinction, and they fought fiercest of all to rise above the universal zero. In this category were all the interrogators, prosecutors, judges, and camp officials who had landed behind bars. And all the theoreticians, dogmatists, and loudmouths, the writers G. Serebryakova, B. Dyakov, and Alden Semyonov, belong here and nowhere else. We have to understand them, and we won't scoff at them. It was painful for them to fall. "When you cut down trees, the chips will fly," was the cheerful proverb of justification. And then suddenly they themselves were chopped off with all the other chips. Prokhorov Pustover describes a scene at Monzovka, a special camp of Bamlag, at the beginning of 1938. To the surprise of all the natives, they brought in some sort of unprecedented special contingent and separated it from the others with great secretiveness. No one had ever yet observed such an arrival. The newcomers wore leather coats, fur caps, woolen and cheviot suits, fashionable shoes and oxfords. By the 20th anniversary of the revolution, this select group had already discovered a standard of taste in clothes which was not available to working people. This book is continued on Cassette 2, Side 1.